Let's take our Bibles this morning and turn to, once again to the book of Hosea. Hosea in chapter 1. This will be Hosea, Prophet to the Gentiles, part 2. As we discussed in the first part of this expository series on this man and his book, being one of God's called out leaders isn't always what it's cracked out to be. Or as the old cowboy adage expressing the same thought goes, there's a whole heck of a lot they didn't tell me when I signed up with this outfit. On the other hand, there's a whole lot of blessings that can't be acquired anywhere else. The fulfillment of just serving Yahweh in whatever capacity He's called you to is literally beyond expression. The thrill of leading someone to the cross and to the empty tomb, or turning someone away from a life of misery and destruction, you know, what else in this life can compare to that? As I pointed out in the previous message, one had better consider seriously the price tag that comes with the calling. But if indeed you are called by God to serve, there's nothing like it in spite of the cost that accompanies it. We need more leaders. Now, some leaders are threatened by other leaders. You know, I'm not sure why, but some just tend to be that way. But we need more leaders. We need more ministries. We need more workers in the field, because the vineyard is the harvest is white and needing to be harvested. And so we need more leaders. We just need to make sure that they're called by God, and as I pointed out in the last message, and not by their own egos. Hosea was unquestionably called by God, because who in their right mind would call themselves to what Hosea initially was required to do? Let's read about it again in Hosea chapter 1 in verses 1 through 3. It says, "The word of Yahweh that came unto Hosea, the son of Beri, in the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah, and the days of Jeroboam, in the son of Josiah, king of Israel." The beginning, and I emphasize, I pointed that out, don't miss the fact, this is the very beginning of his ministry. There's no well-grounded and flourishing ministry at this time. This is right smack dab at the beginning of his calling. "The beginning of the word of Yahweh by Hosea. And Yahweh said to Hosea, Go take unto thee a wife of whoredoms and children of whoredoms, for the land hath committed great whoredom, departing from Yahweh. So he went and took Gomer, the daughter of Diblaim, which conceived and bare him a son." Now, correction. I had stated in the last message that by the wording in verse 2 that one couldn't be sure whether Hosea's children were actually his own. However, from the verbiage in verse 3, it would appear that at least his first son was his own, and I suspect all of the rest. They were children of whoredoms because his wife was a whoredom, not necessarily because they were children as a result of her whoredoms. Verses 3 through 9 now. Verse 3, it says, "So he went and took Gomer, the daughter of Diblaim, which conceived and bare him a son. And Yahweh said to him, Call his name Jezreel, for yet a little while, and I will avenge the blood of Jezreel upon the house of Jehu, and will cause to cease the kingdom of the house of Israel. And it shall come to pass that day that I will break the bow of Israel in the valley of Jezreel. And she conceived again and bore a daughter. And God said unto him, Call her name Lo-Ruhamah, for I will no more have mercy upon the house of Israel, but I will utterly take them away. But I will have mercy upon the house of Judah, and will save them by Yahweh their God, and will not save them by bow, nor by sword, nor by battle, by horses, nor by horsemen. Now when she had weaned Lo-Ruhamah, she conceived and bare a son. Then said God, Call his name Lo-Ami, for ye are not my people, and I will not be your God." Now as can be seen, not only was Hosea's taking a prostitute for a wife to be a testimonial to the house of Israel of her sins, but even the names that God commanded Hosea to call his children were indicative of God's coming judgment upon the house of Israel. Now, for those young parents or prospective parents, either here or those on the tape ministry, let me caution you to be careful what you name your children. When Lynn and I began having children, we decided that we would name our children based more on their meanings than on whether we liked the sound of them or not. There are many instances in the Scriptures where someone was named or even renamed to fit their destiny. Abraham and Sarai, or I should say Abram and Sarai, are probably the first to come to mind. Theirs were changed to Abraham and Sarah, meaning father of many nations and noble female. Slight changes from what they were originally, but nonetheless significant enough that God wanted them changed. It's also interesting to note that what their original names implied. Abram meant high father, and Sarai meant dominating. Now, I have to wonder if possibly it wasn't because of Abram's pride and Sarah's domineering ways that God kept Sarai barren until their names were changed. I don't know, but I do know that one's name in biblical times often had a bearing on one's destiny, or vice versa. Linda, for example, had always liked the name Wendy. That is, until we discovered that it meant wanderer. And we weren't about to name our firstborn daughter by that name. And so we chose Katie instead for our firstborn girl, which means pure one or pure in heart. And anyone who knows our Katie knows indeed that that's what she is. Is there destiny in a name? Well, I was the seventh child, the firstborn son, and my name, Theodore Wyland, means gift of God, Holy Land. To me, it seems inescapable that I would become a Christian. And although I never wanted to become a preacher, I simply couldn't avoid becoming one. Is there destiny in a name? I don't know. You know, only God knows that for sure. But it certainly could be the case. Just a small side note, but one that might be extremely significant to prospective parents. Well, Hosea had no choice when it came to his children's names. However, in this case, they were indicative of the judgment upon the house of Israel more than they were the destiny of his own children. The three names were Jezreel, Lo-Ruhamah, and Lo-Ami, meaning, listen to this, God will sow no mercy or pity on not my people, or his people, that is, signifying Yahweh's divorcement and banishment of the house of Israel for her idolatrous adultery. Now, I'm sure to the average Christian, that at the very least, that this seems strange to be speaking of God and His people in these terms. I'm quite confident that most modern Christians are oblivious to the fact that God was married, let alone divorced. But indeed, He was both. Yahweh's marriage to the nation of Israel is described for us in Exodus chapter 19, which if you'd like to, you can turn there with me. Exodus chapter 19, and I'll be reading verses 1 through 6. Verse 1, it says, "In the third month, when the children of Israel were gone forth out of the land of Egypt, the same day came they into the wilderness of Sinai. For they were departed from Rephidim, and were come to the desert of Sinai, and had pitched in the wilderness, and there Israel camped before the mount. And Moses went up unto God, and Yahweh called unto him out of the mountain, saying, Thus shalt thou say to the house of Jacob, and tell the children of Israel, Ye have seen what I did unto the Egyptians, and how I bare you on eagle's wings, and brought you unto myself. Now therefore, verse 5, if you will obey my voice indeed, and keep my covenant, then you shall be a peculiar treasure unto me above all peoples. For all the earth is mine, and you shall be unto me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words that thou shalt speak unto the children of Israel." Now therein is described Yahweh's proposal of marriage. He's proposing this marriage covenant contract with Israel. He delivers his marriage proposal through Moses to deliver to the Israelites, hoping that they, of course, would agree to the proposal. Note how in verse 5, God promised her that she, that is Israel, would be a peculiar, or that word in the New American Standard is translated special. That's what peculiar meant at that time. A peculiar or a special treasure above all other people, or women, if you will. Now, that's going to be something important for us to remember as we get further into this book. Because as it's declared here, God very clearly chose this one nation of people to be His bride above all other peoples. That's exactly what it says there. You either read it with me or heard it yourself. And some of our politically correct, brainwashed brethren will want to respond to that by declaring, Why, that means that God showed favoritism. And that's right. That's exactly what he did. Isn't that what a husband is supposed to show to his wife? Favoritism? Isn't she supposed to be a special treasure? In today's 20th century vernacular, not necessarily a peculiar treasure. Now, she may be peculiar to other men, but hopefully she's not peculiar to her own husband. But isn't she supposed to be a special treasure? Isn't he to love her more than he loves others or other women? It doesn't mean that he doesn't love others, but that he loves his wife as he should above all others. And so, as a husband to Israel, Yahweh clearly proclaimed his special nuptial love for her above all other nations. And yet there are many preachers today who are telling their flocks that at a later time God changed his mind and made all people to be his bride on equal footing with Israel. Well, we'll have to see later if indeed that this is the case. But first, back to the marriage proposal. Let's pick it up where we left off, Exodus 19, and now let's pick it up with verse 7. And Moses came and called for the elders of the people and laid before their faces all these words which Yahweh commanded him. Verse 8, and all the people answered together and said, all that Yahweh has spoken we will do. And Moses returned the words of the people unto Yahweh. And that, of course, was the bride's acceptance of the proposal. The I do, if you will. Look at verse 8 again. And all the people answered together and said, all that Yahweh has spoken, we will do. I do, we do. And Moses returned the words of the people unto Yahweh. And so Israel became Yahweh's wife and Yahweh her husband. Isaiah 54:5 declares it clearly. There it says, for thy maker is thy husband, the Lord of hosts is his name, and the Redeemer, the Holy One of Israel. For thy maker, speaking to Israel, for thy maker is thine husband. Yet in spite of this special relationship, you know, a relationship with God, and not just a relationship with God, but a marriage relationship. Israel literally was married to Yahweh, the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords, the Omnipotent, Omniscient, Omnipresent, and all the rest of what he is. What a relationship! And yet, in spite of this special relationship with Yahweh, Israel, Yahweh's wife, did not remain faithful to him. Can you imagine that? It became a harlot, worshiping and serving other so-called gods. You know, and on top of it, gods, so-called gods that were made by the hands of men, and that in no way, no fashion, could compare with the husband she had, and yet she still went whoring after them. No one describes it more graphically than does Hosea, and why shouldn't he? The very same thing was happening in his own life. Hosea chapter 2, for example, in verses 5 and verse 13, he says, for their mother has played the harlot. She who conceived them has acted shamefully, for she said, I will go after my lovers, who give me my bread and my water, my wool and my flax, my oil and my drink. Verse 13, and I will punish her for the days of the Baals, when she used to offer sacrifices to them and adorn herself with her earrings and jewelry and follow her lovers so that she forgot me, declares Yahweh. That's what we do. It's no different today. There's nothing new under the sun. That's what we do. Idolatry is adultery on a grand scale. That's what it is. Also, Hosea 4, 12 and 13, Hosea wrote this, my people consult their wooden idol and their diviner's wand informs them, for a spirit of harlotry has led them astray, and they have played the harlot, departing from their God. They offer sacrifices on the tops of the mountains and burn incense on the hills, under oak, poplar, and terebinth. Because their shade is pleasant, therefore your daughters play the harlot, and your brides commit adultery. And as a consequence, Yahweh determined to punish her. Hosea chapter 10, and verses 1 and 2. Israel is a luxuriant vine. He produces fruit for himself. The more his fruit, the more altars he made. In other words, the more that God blessed him, the more altars he made. The richer his land, the better he made his sacred pillars. Their heart is faithless. Now they must bear their guilt. Yahweh will break down their altars and destroy their sacred pillars. But more than that, turn with me now to Jeremiah chapter 3 and verses 1 through 8. Jeremiah chapter 3, here in this chapter, himself describing the same thing, the divorce of the house of Israel and the reason for it. Jeremiah chapter 3, and we'll begin with verse 1. Verse 1, they say, if a man put away his wife, and she go from him, and become another man's, shall she return unto her again? Shall not that land be greatly polluted? But thou hast played the harlot with many lovers. Yet return again to me, saith Yahweh. Lift up thine eyes unto the high places, and see where thou hast not been lying with. New American Standard says, violated. In the ways hast thou sat for them, as the Arabian in the wilderness, and thou hast polluted the land with thy whoredoms and with thy wickedness. Therefore the showers have been withholden, and there has been no latter rain, and thou hast a whore's forehead, thou refusest to be ashamed. Wilt thou not from this time cry unto me, My Father, thou art the guide of my youth? Will he reserve his anger forever? Will he keep it to the end? Behold, thou hast spoken and done evil things as thou couldest. Yahweh said also unto me in the days of Josiah the king, Hast thou seen that which backsliding Israel hath done? She has gone up unto every high mountain and under every green tree, and there has played the harlot. And I said, after she had done all those things, Turn thou unto me, but she returned not. And her treacherous sister Judah saw it. And I saw when for all the causes whereby backsliding Israel committed adultery, I put her away and given her a bill of divorce. Yet her treacherous sister Judah feared not, but went and played the harlot also. That is what the names of Hosea's children were indicative of. Yahweh's was so clearly described by Jeremiah there, especially in verse 8. Yahweh's divorcement of, in this instance, the house of Israel, the 10 northern tribes. And do note that at this time, the house of Judah was not being divorced. Turn to back to Hosea chapter 1, and let's read verse 7 again. Hosea 1 and verse 7, it says, But I will have mercy upon the house of Judah, and will save them by Yahweh their God, and will not save them by bow, nor by sword, nor by battle, by horses, nor by horsemen. Now, what's that talking about? You know, any time, that one sees a promise or a promise prophecy of God fulfilled, it should thrill our souls and engender a greater faith in our God. And it doesn't have to be some prophecy that we see or think we see fulfilled today or about to be fulfilled in the future. But at least for me, when I see a prophecy given in God's Word and then fulfilled in God's Word, it's just as thrilling to me as if I saw it happening before my very eyes, because it's just proof that our God, first, that His God, that His Word is inspired, and that God is indeed truthful to His Word. If you're familiar with that, now, in relation to that, if you're familiar with the historical account of the house of Israel's divorcement, captivity, and banishment, you know that it was at the hands of the Assyrians that it was accomplished. Well, let me tell you, the Assyrians had no intention of stopping with the house of Israel. Sennacherib, king of Assyria, intended to subjugate not only the house of Israel, but Jerusalem and the whole house of Judah as well. But what happened? Sennacherib is right there perched and ready to go. I mean, he's already taken the house of Israel, and he's planning just to go right through the rest of all the other Israelites, the Judahite Israelites, that is, and do the same to them. But what happened? Well, you can read it for yourself in either 2 Kings chapter 19 or 2 Chronicles 32. But in short, Yahweh did just as He promised. Hezekiah, king of Judah, built up his armaments and prepared his men for battle, did everything that he possibly could to win the battle or to be available to God to win the battle in case God would choose them. He and his men and the armaments and all that he did to win the battle against the Assyrians. But all of that was totally unnecessary. Not necessarily wrong. They were prepared to be used by God. But all of it was totally unnecessary. Why? Well, because it was already prophesied. And God saved Judah neither by bow, sword, battle, horses, nor horsemen, but rather by one angel that slaughtered 185,000 Assyrian soldiers in one night, just as God had promised he would by Hosea. Now that thrills me, because there is a prophecy, just a little short prophecy that often is overlooked, but is fulfilled for us in God's holy word. God is indeed true to his every word. And it's best that we don't ever forget that. That we don't forget that God will judge and is judging the secrets of all men through the Christ Yeshua. Romans chapter 2 and verse 16. It's best we don't forget that, because God is true to his every word. And also, let us not forget this either. The other side of the coin is that many as are the promises of God are yes, or fulfilled in or for those of us in Yeshua the Christ. 2 Corinthians chapter 1 and verse 20. Whether it be for judgment or for blessing, God is true to his every word. God is true to his every word. And as he was true to his word to the house of Judah, he was also true to his word concerning the house of Israel. And the house of Israel was divorced, and he caused to cease the kingdom of national Israel. And not only that, but verses 8 and 9 of Hosea 1, or in verses 8 and 9 of Hosea 1, we are also told something else about the house of Israel that seldom gets the attention it deserves. Look at verses Hosea 1 and verses 8 and 9 again. Verse 8 and 9, it says, "And now when she had weaned Lo-Ruhamah, she conceived and bare a son. Then said God, call his name Lo-Ami." I lost my place here. Verse 9. "Then God said, call his name Lo-Ami, for you are not my people, and I will not be your God." Now that, again, doesn't normally get the attention that it deserves. Although the word divorce is not used, that is indeed what is being described in this passage. He, Yahweh, says to Israel the exact opposite of what he said to her when she was in good standing with him as his wife. Let's turn to Leviticus chapter 26. Leviticus 26. Now, we'll begin with verse, it's actually down in verse 9 that we really want to look at, or verse 9 and on, that we really want to see what's being said. But I want you to note how this chapter begins, verses 1 through 4. Leviticus 26, beginning with verse 1, it says, "You shall make you no idols, nor graven image, neither rear you up a standing image, neither shall you set up any image of stone in your land to bow down to it, for I am Yahweh your God." Now, if you think that only applies to idols, you know, that idolatry in the Scriptures applies only to idols that were raised up to look like a god, you need to get my Second Commandment series. And you'll find out that idolatry today includes much, much more than idolatry in the Catholic Church or idolatry of Israel's past times. Anyway, he says, "No image, neither shall you set up any image of stone in your land to bow down to it, for I am Yahweh your God. You shall keep my Sabbaths and reverence my sanctuary. I am Yahweh. If you walk in my statutes and keep my commandments and do them, then I will give you rain in due season, and the land shall yield her increase, and the trees of the field shall yield their fruit." And it continues right from then, saying, here are the blessings. If you'll not adulterate yourself after other gods, and if you'll follow me, here is the blessings that I will provide to you. And the following several verses describe that. And I want to pick it up again with verse 9. Verse 9, he says, "And for I will have respect unto you, and make you fruitful, and multiply you, and establish my covenant with you." What covenant? Well, the marriage covenant of that time. And then what was the result? And then look at verses 11 and 12. "And I will set my tabernacle," listen carefully, "among you, and my soul shall not abhor you." Verse 12. "And I will walk among you, and will be your God, and ye shall be my people." Yahweh promised Israel, "And I shall be your God, and you shall be my people." Now, can you see the marriage relationship or covenant depicted in those words? I hope so. And thus, when she was divorced, all that she had as a result of that relationship would be forfeited or lost, would it not? Including the right and privilege of being known as or called his or Yahweh's people. Hosea chapter 1, and what was it, verse 9, I think. Now, who is it talking about here? Well, it's speaking about the house of Israel, is it not? Those to whom, or at least a portion of those to whom Yahweh had been married. Now, don't lose sight of that. We'll come back to that later in this series. Don't lose sight of the fact of who is being spoken of in Hosea, well, in the whole book of Hosea, but specifically Hosea 1 and 2. The house of Israel, the 10 northern tribes. Now, many people miss the following as well. As a matter of fact, I don't know of one commentary that this can be found in. That is, that in the declaration that the house of Israel would no longer be Yahweh's or God's people, is the promise that those same people would lose their identity as Israel. If you will recall, the name Israel was also the result of another Old Testament name change. Isaac's son Jacob had his name changed by Yahweh to Israel, and it was Jacob Israel who became the progenitor of the 12 tribes of Israel. Well, the name Israel, remember, God often changed names to make it fit what He had planned for these people, for whoever He was going to deal with. In this case, not only Jacob Israel, but more specifically his descendants. The name Israel, that Jacob's name was changed to, literally means ruling with El. El being short for Elohim, the Hebrew word from which we translate our English word God. Thus, Israel means ruling with God. Something that the Israelites were promised that they would do when Yahweh proposed marriage to them. Let's go back to Exodus chapter 19 now. Exodus chapter 19 and verses 5 and 6 once again. Exodus 19 and verses 5 and 6. In verse 5 it says, "Now therefore, if you will obey my voice indeed and keep my covenant, then you shall be a peculiar treasure unto me above all people, for all the earth is mine. And you shall be unto me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation." Now the word kingdom, and I've probably misstated, I think I have misstated this on some previous tapes. I had mentioned that this is the first time in the scriptures that the word kingdom is found. That is not the case, that the Hebrew word that's translated kingdom. I think it's used actually two other times. What I meant to say is that this is the first time that this word kingdom is used, or the Hebrew word that's translated kingdom, is used in relationship to God's kingdom. Never before this is God's kingdom mentioned in the scriptures. So this is the first time when God is proposing marriage to the house of Israel, He says, if you will accept my proposal of marriage, and become my bride, become my wife, my special people, my peculiar treasure, then I will make you a kingdom of priests. In other words, it came into existence with Yahweh's marriage to Israel, this ruling relationship. Now, in that relationship, God was king. Thus, what would that make his wife or his helpmeet? She'd be queen, would she not? Certainly she would. And would thus reign with him, with El, with God, in that relationship. Now, follow with me. If that ruling relationship is implied in the name Israel, as a result of being married to God, then divorcement would also remove that ruling relationship, and she would no longer retain the right to use that name. In other words, these divorced people, although genetically Israelites, they would no longer, at a future point in time, be known as Israel. And they would, over time, even lose their identity. And they would lose their identity as those people and would eventually come to be called by other names. This is something else that we'll come back to in the next message. But first we need to know that although these Israelites deserved all of God's wrath and fury, they deserved to be divorced. Although they deserved to be thrown out completely, we need to know and we need to understand that God still loved them. In chapter 3 Hosea is told to take his adulterous wife back, and once again as a testimonial to what God had in mind for Israel. Turn again to Hosea. Hosea chapter 3, and we'll read verses 1 and 3 at this time. Hosea chapter 3, verse 1, it says, "Then said Yahweh unto me." Now, this is in relation to Hosea and his wife, but again, indicative of what was going on between Yahweh and his wife Israel. "Then said Yahweh unto me, Go yet love a woman beloved of her friend, yet an adulteress according to the love of Yahweh toward the children of Israel, who look to other gods and love flagrants of wine. So I brought her to me for 15 pieces of silver and for a homer." Now, this is he's buying back his wife, Gomer. She's gone a-whoring. He's been married to her. He's gone a-whoring, and she's buying her back. Again, all indicative of what was going on between Israel and God, or what would be going on, part of it in the future. "So I brought her to me for 15 pieces of silver and for a homer of barley and a half a homer of barley. And I said unto her, Thou shalt abide for me many days. Thou shalt not play the harlot. And thou shalt not be for another man, so I will also be for thee." You know, as a matter of fact, Yahweh loved Israel so much that almost in every instance where he had Hosea foretell of her punishment, he immediately follows it up by having Hosea remind them that he, Yahweh, still loves them and intends to take them back sometime in the future. And that's, of course, what he was doing there. And he did it over and over again in nearly every case. In chapter 1, Yahweh first foretells there the house of Israel's impending doom. He declares to them that their kingdom would cease, that he would show them no mercy, and that they would no longer be his people, all of which they deserve for their adultery, idolatry. But then, almost as if he was hearing the prayer of Habakkuk, when he had prayed, "In wrath remember mercy," Yahweh did just that. Now, let's go back to Hosea chapter 1. Previously, he's used the three names of Hosea's children to describe what he was going to do to them. But then he says, in Hosea chapter 1, picking up with verse 9 again, it says, "And then God said, Call his name Lo-Ami, the last of the three children, for ye are not my people, and I will not be your God." Verse 10, "yet." Now, let's stop right there, because that word, that one little word, deserves some attention. God declares all the previous judgments upon Israel, but then he declares, "yet." And in this case, never has Israel heard a more beautiful word. Yet. Nevertheless. But. It's a lot like Romans 6:23 that says, "For the wages of sin is death." But. Nevertheless. Yet. The free gift of God is eternal life through Yeshua the Christ our Lord. It's a lot like that. Look at verses 9. Now look at it again. "Then said God, Call his name Lo-Ami, for you are not my people, and I will not be your God. Yet the number of the children of Israel shall be as the sand of the sea, which cannot be measured nor numbered." Now let's stop there again. No, it was the kingdom or the house of Israel that was to cease, not the Israelites themselves. Amos 9, and Amos deals with the same thing. In Amos chapter 9 and verse 8, he says, "Behold, the eyes of the Lord Yahweh are upon the sinful kingdom, and I will destroy it from off the face of the earth." And notice what's being destroyed, the kingdom. "I will destroy it from off the face of the earth, saving that I will not utterly destroy the house of Jacob, saith Yahweh." In other words, the kingdom was being destroyed, but the Israelites were not. And during the first century A.D., we find that not just two tribes in existence, but all 12. James chapter 1 and verse 1, for example. "James, the servant of God and of the Lord Yeshua the Christ, to the 12 tribes which are scattered abroad, greeting." To the 12 tribes which are scattered abroad. Flavius Josephus, who was a contemporary of James, in Antiquity, in his book, The Antiquity of the Jews, book 11, chapter 5 and verse 2, declares, quote, "Wherefore there are but two tribes in Asia and Europe subject to the Romans, while the 10 tribes are beyond the Euphrates," till now, exactly where they were prophesied by one of the earlier prophets to go, "while the 10 tribes are beyond the Euphrates till now and are an immense multitude and not to be estimated by numbers," end of quote. In perfect fulfillment of what Yahweh promised to Hosea, that the descendants of Israel, the house of Israel in this instance, would become as innumerable as the sand of the seashore. Yes, the kingdom of Israel was destroyed, and God's relationship with them had ended. They were no longer to be known as his people. Their name would be removed from them. They would be just nations or Gentiles amongst other non-Israelite Gentiles. But God, once again, fulfilled his prophecy. James declares they're in existence. Flavius Josephus really declares the fulfillment of what Hosea prophesied, that there was this immense multitude. What's an immense multitude? Well, as many as, could you say, as the sand on the seashore that cannot be measured? I would say a pretty good fulfillment of what Hosea prophesied. All of that, they would become innumerable as the sand on the seashore. But that is not the most glorious part of God's promise to these divorced Israelites, or I guess soon-to-be divorced Israelites, looking from the perspective of Hosea. Not at all. Let's read the rest of verse 10. Hosea chapter 1, verse 10. Yet the number of the children of Israel shall be as the sand of the sea, which cannot be measured nor numbered. And then the rest of it. And it shall come to pass that in the place where it was said unto them, ye are not my people, there it shall be said unto them, ye are sons of the living God. Now, do you understand what you just read? If you do, then you understand more than do the vast majority of modern commentators, on this verse. Out of the 8 commentaries that I have in my possession, 7 of them clearly read into this verse their own preconceived ideas, instead of letting God and this passage of Scripture itself dictate their conclusions. The majority of commentators at this point in this passage, without justification, I may add, suddenly switch from a literal interpretation to a figurative or quote-unquote spiritual interpretation. And not only that, but they take a prophecy clearly made to a specific nation of people and indiscriminately apply it to another group of people, never, not once, anywhere mentioned in the prophecy. And as a consequence, they leave this prophecy unfulfilled, at least in their theology, and quote-unquote, make God a liar. Now, would you like to know how they do that? Well, then you'll have to stay tuned for Hosea, Prophet to the Gentiles, Part 3.